Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This podcast is a Roifield Brown production. Find others on iTunes.
All right. Yeah, I know.
Skylines is brought to you by 100 Resilient Cities. Pioneered by the Rockefeller Foundation, 100 Resilient Cities is helping cities around the world become more resilient to the physical, social, and economic challenges of the 21st century. You can find out more at 100resilientcities.org.
This is a Manhattan-bound B Express train. The next stop is Grand Street.
Mind the gap.
Welcome to Skylines, the City Metric podcast. I'm John.
And I'm Stephanie, and we're here for Hit the North Part 2, where we're going to talk about football, leisure, northern cities, and employment, and trains.
Yay, trains!
In Liverpool and Manchester, there's a specific vibe. You disseminate information based around football.
I think the fact that I think it's the largest student population in Europe, 60,000 students, that absolutely makes it a very dynamic city.
So, John, you are not interested in sport broadly and football specifically, am I right?
Yeah, I mean, but I'm more sort of disinterested than uninterested. It's like I just don't get it. Like, I made a couple of attempts to try and be a normal child because like, there was loads of sport in my school. But it's just like I literally, you know, there's magic eye diagrams where like some people can just never see them. I'm like that with a football pitch. I can't see what everyone else sees. And like I'm not proud of this. I kind of think I'm missing out. I remember how excited everyone got during the World Cup a couple of years ago. And it's like there is this whole realm of human pleasure that's completely cut off to me. So why are we doing this again?
Well, on that slightly pessimistic note, we've brought someone in to talk about football and sport and either turn you onto it or chat about the culture around it so the missing part of your brain doesn't matter. So we're joined by Neil Atkinson, who's from the hugely successful Anfield Rap.
I feel like you've got the wrong person in.
Have
you? I don't like football very much, so I'm sort of broadly speaking with John in that, you know, I watch other football mainly to see how it impacts upon Liverpool. I like Liverpool Football Club, football itself. It's one of them. I'm actually reading a great book at the minute by Daniel Gray. I think it's called 50 Delights, and it's 50 Things to Love About Modern Football. And Dan makes a great claim for your attention and time about things like seeing stadia from trains and things like that as a true delight of football still. So he loves football, and he loves all the things about football, whereas I love Liverpool and all the things about Liverpool winning. That's my MO. But I think this idea that people, and I think that this is one of the things that football does that's a bit negative, really, is that it tends to sort of, I mean, I think most cultural activities do, but it tends to make people who don't necessarily like it feel excluded. And I think that that's a bit of a shame, because there's no reason for anybody to feel excluded even if they don't like it. But because, you know, if you list anything that becomes a separate activity, then it has its own jokes, its own reference points, its own things that therefore make you, there's a World Cup going on and you're wondering why everyone's getting carried away and no one actually takes the time to say, John, the World Cup might not be for you, but actually Division 2 football might be with 500 people in the cold, in the wet. It could inform a bleak outlook that you could get around.
You're really selling this here.
Well,
the cold and the wet. And
can we row you back a bit and ask about Liverpool and football? So you Did you grow up a football fan?
Yeah, very much so. I had my first game when I was five, and you know, it was me and dad was from Anfield, and you know, so you go. My granddad still lives there, and so you know, walk into the stadium from there. He'd rang the pitch announcer to get them to say something about me. At the very least, I can remember on my seventh birthday. I sort of might have a false memory of it when I was five and a half, so I'm not quite sure on that one. But it definitely happened when I was seven, and so yeah, very much so. And it's something which you know immediately hits. And I do think that there's, to run myself back forwards on John's thing there, I think that there is something where when you are the first time you see a pitch, and any pitch, I mean, this is any pitch, I mean, this is where I do end up sounding like a football romantic, but if you take me up a set of steps and then introduce a green space,
the moment where you walk out into that,
I can still remember that. I can remember that from when I'm younger at Anfield, and then when there's a break, when there's the summer, and then I didn't get to go to the first game of the season, I was on holiday, which was nice. But when I went recently, I was like, wow, there it is, this huge green thing that they're all going to run around on. And I think that that's something which is, it is adolescent, or perhaps not even adolescent, it's a childlike, this is a wonderful, marvellous thing that they're going to run around on this and people are going to watch. So I do like that, and I do think that that's something which people who really like football, it does stay with them. And so what that means is that when you do, for instance, watch games on television, you get that feeling of that without necessarily having to be there.
I remember it really distinctly. I went a couple of weeks ago and saw Accrington Stanley play West Ham, which was a bizarre spectacle on so many levels. But walking up, and I'm not a big fan of the new West Ham stadium for a lot of reasons, but walking up and just opening out into that big space, it's instinctual, it's almost physical, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a rush. It's a rush of energy and anticipation for the thing that you're about to see. One of the things that, again, you can sound ridiculous and like you're trying to be some sort of Tim Pot Alan Bennett, but the smell of the grass, you very rarely actually smell that much grass without it being interfered with other things. So, for instance, when you imagine yourself walking through a park, you can't really smell turf. You can smell trees, you can smell plants, you can smell flowers. But when you actually, there's nothing else, there's just grass here. And it's that, things like that, I think, are quite visceral sort of things that evoke football in a way in which lots of other things don't.
Okay, so despite the fact I think I've watched two football games in my life, and in both of them England went out of the World Cup, so I realised I was actually harming the national cause with my attention, so I just stopped. But despite that, I would actually say that on some level I'm a West Ham supporter. I don't care, but I'm a West Ham supporter because of where I'm from, and because my dad and my granddad are West Ham supporters, and when I was a kid walking around, you could tell how West Ham was doing by the noises coming from the other houses. So this idea of like it being a sort of geographical phenomenon, where in Liverpool is Anfield?
Anfield is, it's about 2-3 miles northeast out of the city centre. So you can walk it from the city. You wouldn't, I've done it about sort of 15-20 times, but you wouldn't necessarily choose to.
So can we talk about that kind of geography within cities? Because to me this is so interesting, because if you go to a derby match in Manchester, one of the things that the city fans will chant at United supporters is "fuck off back to Salford."
Yeah.
Like, talk to me about that in Liverpool. What is the kind of geographical distribution?
Well, no, there is. I mean, you know, you can walk within 400 yards of Anfield is Goodison. I actually, someone who comes and does one of our shows, Philippa.
Sorry, is Goodison the Everton ground? Yes, that's a very basic question. Yeah. You're going to have to spell these things out for me.
Goodison is the Everton ground, and Goodison is within 400 yards. It's the other side of Stanley Park. And when I go to see Liverpool this season, I've been picked up by Philippa afterwards. She was coming to do a show with us, and she parks in Goodison. So I just walk across from Anfield, and there it is. And literally, when I say park, she parks in the back of their shop. That's where she was parking there. So it's the Everton open that and take the money from the parking. So that's how close it is, and that's how close Liverpool and Everton are.
That's thrown me a bit, because I was in Liverpool a couple of weeks ago. Someone told me the best view of the city was to be had from Everton Park. And it's an absolutely fantastic view from up there. But that was, you know, in walking distance to the north of the city. So I assumed that Everton was up there somewhere. So therefore, in my mind, I sort of assumed Anfield must be to the south.
No. Everton and Liverpool are very, very close indeed. So Everton is, Liverpool is actually sort of, Liverpool Football Club is in Anfield. Anfield is right next to Everton. As terms of sort of lines that you can draw through. They're both in the same parliamentary constituency, for instance.
Because in London, they're reasonably widely geographically distributed,
aren't
they?
See, this is really interesting to me, because the North West, I think of those cities as football cities. I think of Manchester as a football city, Liverpool as a football city. London has football areas, in my mind. Why do you think there is that kind of difference in how people engage in it?
Because people, one of the, for instance, you know if Liverpool or Everton are playing at home. if you're going to go out in Liverpool. You're impacted by that information. Literally, you're impacted by it with the flow of the traffic. You're impacted by it by the decisions that are made. Even in terms, to a certain extent, I think it's a consideration of, for instance, when you are or aren't putting events on in a city like Liverpool, and even in a city like Manchester, which is bigger than Liverpool. Whereas London's got its own thing. London simply exists completely separate to the rhythms of its football teams. Its football teams just happen to be in London. So, for instance, a really good example of that is that, you know, Arsenal doesn't actually exist as a place. Arsenal isn't really a place. It's a part, you know, it's Holloway, North London, but the club's called Arsenal. It's not got that link.
It's because it was named after the Woolwich Arsenal, where they were originally based, which exactly. Was where they built all the armaments. So
exactly. So it's not quite, you know, it doesn't even in the name have a sense of geography. And I think in general, London, you're right, it's got football areas and areas where you're, for instance, you know, the first time you see East Ham, West Ham, you evoke sort of football iconography, for want of a better phrase. But you don't get that sort of with a lot of the other London teams, because London gets on with the business of being London. That's what it is. It's the capital of the country. It's got all, you know, it's got 6, 7, 8 million people. Whereas Liverpool, if 50,000 people, 55,000 people, 60,000 people come to Liverpool for a cultural event, well, if that was any other cultural event apart from football, it'd be on the front page of the local paper. Similarly with Manchester, you know, if you can get 80 to 100,000 people moving around Manchester, that's a massive deal. And so I think that's not to say that these are small cities, because they're not, but they have a centre of gravity, and football becomes that centre of gravity. And I think that's a big deal. And like on the most basic sense, recently my partner was asking me what to do for a birthday and when. And her first three questions, and she likes football, but she doesn't love football. But her first three questions were about Liverpool's fixtures. If I say almost everybody's, I'm generalising, but it's how a lot of social circles work in Liverpool, that even if you're not going to these games, if they're away or whatever, you still need to have this piece of information. So, for instance, I'm not going to ask people to meet on my birthday at 7 o'clock because Liverpool are kicking off at 5:30.
Yes, it's going to be impossible to get into.
Because it means that we're not going to be able to go to that bar, that bar, that bar, or that bar at that stage, but we might be able to later on. And all this sort of thing is a live thing, whereas in London, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, but in London, basically, just getting on with the business of everywhere. Yes, it might be busy, but it might be busy for a billion reasons, not just for...
It's a function of scale.
Yeah, because I live in North London. To get between my house and my in-laws, one of the routes we use is not far from the Arsenal Stadium. We have to know if they're playing, because it does interrupt the traffic. But that's a relatively contained area. It's a couple of square miles, which in London, that's not that much.
Exactly.
Whereas, yeah, and I think also the point you made about, you know, 50,000 people coming to Liverpool is a big increase in Liverpool's population that day. Well, like a million people commute into London every day, kind of thing. So it just doesn't make...
So what about how that feeds back into the culture then? Because I feel like in London you have these localised football cultures. I'm about to move to New Cross and it's kind of Millwall. You know, you have Millwall pubs and things like that, but it's nothing like the scale of there is music, there is fanzines, there is stuff going on back in Manchester where the kind of rhythm of the culture moves around football, like you say. Is that your experience in Liverpool as well?
Yeah, hugely, hugely. Liverpool and Manchester, I think, are the two, I'd say, the two best examples. I think that the North East might make some noises about that. But I think in Liverpool and Manchester, there's a specific vibe. You disseminate information based around football matches. So, for instance, the guy who runs Africa OEA, which is the biggest free festival of African music in the world, I think, well, certainly in Europe, comes on our show. And now he comes on our show to talk about Tottenham, because he's a Tottenham supporter. But when he originally came on, he came on to talk about this because we were a decent way to speak to people both inside and outside of Liverpool who will be listening and who will be culturally active. And I think that one of the things that Liverpool and Manchester does, and I'm thinking more about Manchester United than Manchester City, but that could be me being unfair, but one of the things that Liverpool and Manchester...
Sounds fine to me.
One of the things that Liverpool and Manchester do really, really well...
I don't get that joke.
One of the things that Liverpool and Manchester do really, really well, and Liverpool is... link in sort of is that there is, if you go to the match, that doesn't mean that you're just simply a football supporter, you've got another set of activities. So, for instance, there is, you know, I sent you both a picture before this of a Manchester United away end, and when you see a Manchester United away end, and one of the things that would be startling to a non-football supporter is what you used to see when you see football crowds is lots of people wearing replica football shirts, and they were all wearing black. And one of the reasons for that is because there's a link in terms of in Liverpool and in Manchester. And it's been historical. I mean, when you look back at the infamous panorama footage of the early 60s of the cops swaying and singing, they're all wearing suits. They've all either come from a job or they're going to go out that night. And one of the things that's there in sort of in the post-casual culture of the late 70s, early 80s and keeps moving forward is the idea that you're going to go to the game, but you're going to go out after. that Unite doesn't stop when the final whistle goes. We're not all getting in our cars and going back to where we live. That this event here in the middle is in the middle of the day. So you might have started to meet your friends at 11, you might end up leaving them at 12 o'clock, you might go to a gig, you might go to do something else. All this stuff begins to feed in and filter in. And I think that's something which, as I say, is probably surprises a lot of people who either don't...
I think it's misunderstood, isn't it? People kind of go, yeah.
I think if you don't live in a football city, and if you don't live in... And I think it's a northern... I think it's more of a northern thing, but I wouldn't necessarily completely generalise. But that's... It is sort of this idea that, well, yeah, this is, we're doing this, and then we're going here, and then we're going here, we might go out for tea, we might go somewhere nice. So you need to therefore not necessarily, you don't wear a football kit. You know, you just look ridiculous.
To talk more about that cultural aspect of the North, I am joined by the North's culture czar. He's a BBC Six music radio presenter who's written multiple books about being in the North, and most importantly, he's a New Statesman contributor. It's down the line, he's walking through windy Jarrow, but here we are with Stuart McConey.
So tell me about, you're recreating the whole route of the Jarrow marches.
Yeah. Basically, on Wednesday, October 5th, 1936, they set out from Church in Jarrow. They arrived in London on Halloween. I'm going to do that exactly day by day as they did it, staying in the places they stayed every night. So I won't go through them all, but it begins something like Chesterley Street, Ferry Hill, Darlington, Ripon. I think I get my first rest day after Harrogate in about 7 days' time. Just using the framework of their walk and what they did to sort of celebrate what they did, but also to look at what Britain was like 80 years on. Because I think there's quite a few similarities without wishing to... kind of, you know, without wishing to find stuff where none exist. I think there are some similarities between 1936 and then a Tory government had just been re-elected with an increased majority in 36, but there was this idea of a real gap between the North and the South, or certainly metropolitan Britain and the North. Interesting, and I went to the Jarrow Fun Day, the 80th anniversary Jarrow Fun Day, which I just wrote a little blog, I don't know if anyone's going to use it, I just wrote a little piece for online about it, because I said, you know, the irony of this is not lost on anyone, of course. It relive those heady days of rickets and the means test on the Bounty Castle, you know. That's what I'm doing.
You mentioned there that kind of divide between the North and the metropolitan South, and I think that is, I mean, that's, you know, statistically we know that's kind of stronger than ever. We were talking earlier in the podcast about one in three graduates now moves to London. I mean, there's an incredible brain drain going on. What's been your sort of sense of that, revisiting politics and revisiting a bit of the history of the North?
What baffles me is, unless London's infrastructure... In terms of housing, I mean, social housing is a thing of the past almost, isn't it? I mean, I always wonder how London will simply house its nurses and primary school teachers and stuff like that. I mean, that's surely going to be somewhere down the line, if not now, a massive problem. But I do get a sense that all our major cities are becoming, you know, without losing their character, quite dynamically alike, like London, I think. But I think once you step outside... of those big cities, you know, once you get away from the Costas and the, you know, and all that sort of stuff, and the hipster courts, and that, I think you really notice that difference when you go through, like I've done in the last few years in books. I mean, towns like the one I'm from, Wigan, and towns like the ones I'm going through on this floor, like Chester Street, I mean, you do notice another Britain, and I'm not quite sure if I could put exactly into words what that is, but I just get the feeling that there is a world going on that's perhaps not obsessed with the same things that, you know, metropolitan issues are. I mean, I don't know, in terms of politics, I don't know if the same things exercise them. I mean, I did think, I don't know if this is going off on a tangent, but I did think that I detected a huge amount of metropolitan hauteur, if you like, and a kind of snobbery after Brexit. Certainly had that sort of high-handed metropolitan viewpoint that I think some people, your Rochdales and your Rotherhams do feel, you know, I think they do feel that to a certain extent they're being left behind. And then when they say you can't get a job because the local food processing factory only takes up Romanians, then they're a racist. And I can share a little bit. I can sympathise with some of that anger, really, saying I'm not a racist. And but you keep telling me I am. Just a natural assumption that your London or metropolitan journalist is going to come and file, I think, file some piece of With a Britain Today, you know.
Yeah, kind of poverty safari.
Exactly. Yeah. There's going to be this, I have been to talk to the savages of Jarrow about, you know, how they are so out of touch with our modern world. You know, that's because I've read quite a few of those pieces, those we go up north to find out who voted Leave, you know, as if they're these things, as if no one in their right mind would have done that. It's like my, you know, the sort of Blairite scum kind of thing, I guess, which were bandied about by the Corbynistas. There's still a lot of, you go to Sedgefield, where I'm going tonight, they quite like Tony Blair. Because they're less bothered about the Iraq War than they are about jobs and houses and fewer staff and minimum wage. And why shouldn't they be?
Yeah, the things that directly affect your life versus...
Exactly, yeah.
Is the feeling different in Manchester? Is it notably kind of, as you cross that boundary, you say, you know, you get out of Manchester and it feels like a different Britain. What's kind of the situation in Manchester?
Manchester's always unique, I think. It has this unique temperament in history. These days, I think it's the largest student population in Europe, 60,000 students there. That absolutely affects the city, makes it a very dynamic city, makes it a very open kind of city, I think. I mean, when the BBC were moving to Salford, a few people at the BBC, a few people of different ethnic backgrounds that I knew in London were saying some genuine, I think, trepidation. Are we going to encounter much in the way of racism? And I said, no. I said, you know, that's no more than you would anywhere else. And I said, nothing. I can't really vouch for Blackburn or Wigan, my towns, you might. There might be pockets of it. I said, but I do think in places like Manchester and Liverpool, no, because they are. Without wanting to romanticise them, always been rich cultural mixes, you know, diverse and that sort of thing. And I think Manchester's got this unusual history because it, you know, with some justification again, claims to have invented everything from feminism to communism to vegetarianism to the computer to the, you know, industrial Britain was formed there, you know, the technological revolution is formed there. They split the atom there. So with some justification, Manchester's the first modern city in the world. So and boy, does it know that. Though, it's not got a Michelin star yet, and that rankled so much with it, because Liverpool has. But it's always been unique, because, you know, it pulls off this incredible bit of civic and industrial chutzpah in the 19th century, when it steals the sea from under the nose of Liverpool by building the Manchester Ship Canal, and steals all Liverpool's trade and brings it inland. So it's got this... It's always had this kind of non-conformist dynamic streak. Chris Fraser can argue, you know, it's the Liverpool gentleman and the Manchester man. Liverpool was a much more aristocratic almost kind of city. Liverpool had money in shipping, and the ship owners by and large were gentlemen. You know, they were landed gentry. Manchester's money was made in dirty stuff like cotton and coal, and its owners were much more like the people in brass. There were some have told themselves you'd got lucky, and they had no airs and graces. And they were seen as dirty fingernailed money making hucksters compared to the rather rarefied aristocrats of Liverpool. I think Manchester's always had a bit of that about it. That it believes its own press, which is one of the most irritating things about Manchester. You can't turn a corner in Manchester without some bloody bit of civic art telling you how great Manchester is, and that gets worrying. But, you know, as cities go, maybe it's got some justification for it.
Can I talk to you as well about that recent history? Because you mentioned Media City, obviously, work there now. And it kind of feels like the industry's gone from cotton and coal to doing media, radio, music. It's very kind of digital oriented, it's very young. How have you seen the city change since you kind of installed Six Music there?
I think that change has been the most obvious shift of a shift that's going on since the bomb. And again,
so we should explain that for our international readers.
We should explain. There was a bomb at the Arndale Centre in
97, was it?
90, mid 90s. I should know these things. It's the mid 90s. There was a bomb at the aeroplane, a bomb at the Arndale Centre, which no one was hurt, but there was a lot of civic damage, structural damage, and And as was the case often in Belfast, that prompted a period of sort of civic renewal. Now, some people see the modern Manchester dated from that point. It's neat, it's done quite well, but it's kind of right, I think. Certainly, the Manchester I knew as a teenager, the Manchester I would get the number 32 egg yolk GMPTE bus into from Wigan to go up to buy records and see gigs when I was 15. Is completely different. And I think if you listen to, say, the music of Joy Division, you hear the Manchester of the late 1970s, the desertedness. The streets were empty. There were whole bits of the city you would never go to. Some of the ones, the very place where Media City is now, was a bit of Manchester no one in their right mind would have gone to after dark, unless to sort of avail themselves of various, you know, illicit places. So I think the Manchester of Joy Division, you can hear that late 70s in the. You can hear the emptiness. It sounds like Hume at night, those deserted walkways in the sky, the sort of, you know, kiss-stained escalators and lifts and stuff like that. You can kind of hear that. But a city that hasn't changed that much since the war, really. And I think, you know, you very much hear that in the Smiths. I put very much in Joy Division. And then something kind of changes. Maybe it's the bomb, although that's a bit like... But it goes through a kind of period of... I don't know what I call skinny latification. You know, where you suddenly can't... From the being of... You couldn't get a decent cup of coffee, imagine, in 1982. And then suddenly now you can't move to places where you can get a decent cup of coffee. And I think the bomb was a big part of that. I don't know if it's entirely that. I'm not sufficiently expert in economic matters to know whether there were other economic forces going on at work. Maybe the European Union, who knows, that were putting money into Manchester. But I think that certainly, the bomb did have an effect. And I think it's a neat starting point to say that the modern Manchester sort of begins there, I think. And also Media City, that's sort of been the most obvious, I think, recent move. And I think... The reaction that got initially, the hostility and suspicion and resentment that got from some London media people, I think just shows what still a monumental amount of snobbery there is. You know, I read Giles Corran wrote a piece that I've referred to many times, a piece that talks about how he found it intolerable that he had to leave his wife and family for an evening to go to Manchester to promote his new book. That was ridiculous. Who would thought of that system? It was a ridiculous system, you know what I mean? Which prompted me to say that if every penny spent on building Media City had simply been spent to screw up Giles Corran's day, that it was money well spent, I felt. But that's just me. But there was an awful lot of that, an awful lot of sort of prejudice trying to dress itself as common sense. Well, everyone knows that all the stuff's in London, so they should have just left it here. You know, and that sort of thing that's amused people up north for a while, you know, TV, evenings of TV devoted to Routemaster buses and, you know, the closing of BBC TV Centre, which frankly people in Oddsall and Levenshulme couldn't give a monkey's back, you know. But they've been watching Granada television, they've been watching Tony Wilson all their lives.
Well, exactly, that's what I was just going to say. If you don't think Manchester's got a media history, then what have you been spending your time on? Because After Dark, For the Sound of Midnight, Granada, like...
That's a very good point, Stephanie. And when Peter Salmon, the much missed former director of BBC North, who's now gone, he got me involved in a couple of sort of early, you know, welcome to Manchester, people of London, you know, sort of smoothing the passage into, which again amused me a bit, because I seem to recall when Northerners go to London, it was get on your back, mate. I don't recall anyone ever meeting me when I went to work at the NME, you know, at Euston Station with a goodie bag full of helpful hints. But I'm joking, of course, in my sort of chippy way. But I did say to him, one thing you'll find, Peter, he said, we've done some research, and like loads of people don't watch the BBC or listen to the BBC. They don't get this news from the BBC. And I said, you've got to remember, Peter, well, of course, Peter would know, he grew up in Burnley. I said, you've got to remember Granada. We had the best, you know, regional TV franchise in the world. We had world in action, and all those great music programs, Tony Wilson, Coronation Street. I said, you know, as growing up as television for me, growing up as a kid, wasn't the BBC, which was rather staid and aloof, kind of remote. It was Granada. So then that, you know, it's always had the Guardian, you know, it's always had this fantastic, strong media presence and character. And I think people usually sometimes forget that. They regard themselves as sort of to the manor born in terms of being everyone's first choice for media. But Manchester's got a rich, independent media history.
Do you find, since Media City's been installed by the city, does feel different?
Yeah, I think it does. I think it does, but as I said, I think it's part of an ongoing wave of difference has been. And I can understand why, to a certain extent, Liverpool and Birmingham kind of grumbled at it a bit, because it seems it's always Manchester, you know. I mean, Birmingham's got a perfectly brilliant system of BBC set up in the mailbox, which they then just seem to have turned their back on, which I probably, like, God knows why, I don't understand. But, you know, Manchester seems to win out. You can kind of understand. You can understand why the city sometimes go, roll their eyes and go, not Manchester again. Because from football to music, you know, it does seem to. I was going to say punch above its weight, but then again, its weight is considerable, I suppose. It's arguably Britain's second city.
So what? I mean, obviously, big, tough, nebulous question, but we've talked about the past and we've talked about the present. So what do you think would be a kind of good future for Manchester, and maybe in kind of trying to spread some of that around the north a bit?
Yeah. Well, people talk about this Northern Powerhouse thing, and I get asked a lot. I do some evenings with where I read some of my books and stuff, and people have started to ask me about the Northern Powerhouse. And I have to say, I don't know what to say about that. To a certain extent, I think people automatically, because it was seen as the brainchild of George Osborne, hey, remember him? Because it was seen as George Osborne's brainchild, people have automatically taken a dislike to it, because they see Osborne's part and, you know, discredited old regime. But I don't know. Some people who I know, like Helen Pitt, who's the Guardian's Northern editor, who is, you know, not a fool, thinks it's a great idea, and you know, it's very behind it. And I do know, from my own point of view, I don't know quite what it means. I don't know quite what that means, to Northern Powerhouse. So it's difficult from that point of view for me to say. But I do know that if one of the things Osborne meant, I think, was the fact that it's ludicrous that I can get from Manchester to London in 2 hours, and it takes me almost the same time to get from Manchester to Wakefield, which is, you know, a big town on the other side of the Pennine. And I do think that if it's about increasing those transport links so you get a kind of connected hub of stuff there, I wouldn't have a problem with that. It's not going to mean the cities lose their individuality. Leeds and Manchester are always going to hate each other. Liverpool and Manchester are always going to hate each other. And when I say hate each other, I mean in a good way. I don't mean hatred. I don't mean a kind of corrosive hatred. I mean rivalry, you know, the rivalry that comes from sport and music and football. But I think in some ways it's the grit in the oyster that makes the pearl. You know, a certain amount of that kind of rivalry is a turbine for cultural change and cultural achievement, I think. So that's, you know, I think those cities will always maintain a massive character of their own. But I perhaps do see Manchester becoming at the heart of a sort of, I think, what the geographical people call it, is a megalopolis, you know, a kind of a population centre and a cultural centre and an industrial centre, well, industrial economic centre, to sort of rival London.
I mean, if we can pull it off.
How does football affect the relationship between Liverpool and Manchester, which are, you know, two of the most important cities in the north, and they're actually really close together?
Yeah, really close. Negatively, really, and I think it's a little bit of a shame because Liverpool and Manchester have more in common. I think the similarities aspect is slightly overblown. Certainly culturally, I think it's slightly overblown. I think, again, it's a cheap sort of generalisation and point, but if you look, for instance, Liverpool's music sort of looks out at the Atlantic, whereas Manchester's music turns back in towards the rest of England and Europe, just as an example of this. But there's lots and lots in common, and I think it has grown to have a little bit of a negative impact. It doesn't have to. You know, you don't have to necessarily view Manchester as different and alien, firstly, because it isn't. But I think it has sort of... And as I say, we work quite closely with a couple of people who contribute to Manchester sort of football media, and we get on very, very well. And I know one of them likes to spend a lot of time in Liverpool because he likes Liverpool, frankly. But what that means is that it often leads to people sort of just simply writing off the idea that there can be that sort of close link. And I think that the example I used before when I was speaking to Steph elsewhere was I don't understand why no one in Liverpool is seemingly pushing for there to be a much better transport link between Liverpool city centre and Media City. But it's almost as though that would feel as though it tarnished something. So at the minute, it takes you somewhere between 75 minutes and 90 minutes to get from Liverpool city centre. That's the city centre to Media City. So if you live anywhere else in Liverpool other than the city centre, you've got to get to the city centre.
Sorry, we should say Media City is kind of a new business area in
yeah,
it's, Manchester.
It's where Salford. They moved the BBC up there. Yeah. So it's Salford. Salford's closer to Liverpool than many other parts of Manchester. And you can, if you've got a completely clear run, you could drive it in 30, 40 minutes.
You never have a completely clear
run. You know, for all the talk of, for instance, HS3 and things like that around Liverpool, Manchester, Sheffield, Hull, making it quicker to get from Liverpool city centre to Manchester city centre isn't the problem. But if you could make it quicker to get from Liverpool to Media City, then what you'd have is lots of the people who currently work in Media City, it would actually open up the idea that they could live in Liverpool. It's quite cheap to live in Liverpool, and it's a very nice place to live, Liverpool city centre. It's where I live, and you know, you've got loads and loads of amenities and things that you'd want, all within walking distance, and you can get away with paying, you know, a sort of 500, 600 quid a month in terms of rent for a city centre flat. That's what you can do. But at the minute, that's not an option, because what you have to do if you want to do it on public transport is go from Liverpool city centre, go to Manchester Piccadilly, change, get a tram, come back out and go from there. And it's a complete, it's ludicrous. But no one, as I say, I've not seen anything mooted. Now,
Firstly, I should spell out for the listeners that you missed a really magnificent look on Stephanie's face when we were talking about how high rents in Liverpool were.
I just went to rent a flat and was asked by the estate agent to make an offer in terms of monthly rent.
God. We should do a follow-up on your experience.
We should do a follow-up. Yeah, I have a flat now for listeners who are following my housing crisis.
But going back to transporting, when I was in Liverpool, I met the guy who runs Joe Anderson's office. Which is very exciting. As it turns out, he reads City Metric, which is always nice. I said, "Oh, I love City Metric. Bit London centric." Yeah, fair enough. We were talking about. I asked him how he felt about the idea that Manchester was kind of increasingly being treated as the capital of the North, for want of a better way of putting it. And like, you know, if we ever did win the argument for moving the actual capital out of London, I think it would go to Manchester. There's not really anywhere else it's going. That is a plausible candidate. I said, "Yeah, how does that feel as a Scouser?" He's like, "I'd be happy with that. I would be much happier with the capital much nearer." And you know, I was actually surprised by that, because you hear so much about the rivalries.
No, people would be happy with that. And I think that, you know, there is that sort of tension between Liverpool and Manchester, and it's ongoing. But I think in general, Liverpool's broadly speaking aware of the fact that it's part of the Northwest. I don't think Liverpool, I'm generalising, but I don't think Liverpool sort of sees itself as part of the North. I think Liverpool sees itself as part of the Northwest. You know, for instance, I don't think there's people in Liverpool who are absolutely desperate to make common ground with Doncaster. But they can see
is anyone desperate to make common ground with Doncaster?
But you can see how Liverpool could become sort of, you know, can see what happens in Liverpool and what happens in Manchester have a knock-on effect to one another and you know, literally have done for hundreds of years. You know, we were looking to do a little bit of work recently with the Anfield Wrap, and we were looking to sort of tender for it in Liverpool and Manchester, and someone went to one of our guys, went, "Oh, we support United, is that all right?" As though we were going to go, "Well, no, we wouldn't want to give him money." Utterly ridiculous, but... That was someone in Manchester. It wasn't someone in Liverpool. And then there's another story I've got of a friend of mine who used to work in Manchester who was once accosted by someone who said, "You take your butties, don't you?" And he went, "No, I buy me lunch when I'm in work." And he went, "What, you spend the Scouse pound in Manchester?" So there's loads and loads of, you know, but these are extreme examples of people being, I think, utterly ridiculous. You know, Liverpool and Manchester are linked, and there's lots and lots of cross-pollination. There's lots of people who would view themselves as being Mancunians who live or work in Liverpool, and there's lots and lots of people who are from Liverpool who work in Manchester. The issue is that the transport links aren't great.
The next train to depart platform 2 will be the 1400
Well, since we're talking about the North, the podcast wouldn't be complete without a bit of misery.
I love the way you say that, like, misery is an entirely northern phenomenon. Like, you know, I'm pretty miserable.
I think it's not an exclusively northern phenomenon, but it's a necessary part of northern identity.
I'm saying I'm 70% water and 30% misery, so... Yeah, so what misery are we talking here?
Well, to fulfil our misery quotient, because we're too perky in here, we went to Twitter and we asked you whether you are a northerner who's moved down south, or indeed if you're a southerner who's moved up north, and we asked you to tell us why you made the move, what it is you miss, and if there's something that would tempt you back. John, would you ever be tempted up north?
I mean, no is the answer, but not as a reflection on the North, that's kind of a sort of personal thing that just like, you know, my family are down here, my wife's family are down here, you know, the industry I work in is down here. But I do kind of feel sad about that. I mean, particularly Manchester, there's a lot of, I would quite happily move to Manchester, a remotely plausible thing, but it just isn't in terms of my career or my family or whatever. So this is actually a really boring answer. Sorry. I like trams. Trams are good. I mean, basically, I just like trams.
I mean, you could just move to Brixton.
There are no trams in Brixton.
Are there not trams in Brixton?
They're in Croydon.
Croydon. It's all, I mean, come on.
This is terrible.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Well, I'm getting more offended by this than... let's move on before I get angry. So let's read out some tweets. Helpfully, the first reply to Stephanie's tweet asking for things people miss about the North was from Stephanie herself, saying, "I, for instance, miss good jokes," to which I replied, "Yes, but that's just because you work with Stephen," to which Stephanie replied, "See?"
This is the great banter we have in the New Statesman offices. You can, if you follow John and I on Twitter, you can, you know, get all sorts of this great off the cuff content.
Sharing the misery. I mean, we did warn you this bit was going to be miserable.
The interesting thing about this was I kind of put this tweet out and we got lots of, like, serious answers about people moving for jobs. We got a lot of people talking about missing air quality and being able to breathe and things like that. But it's clearly something people feel really impassioned about, because for the first time, multiple people sent me quite long, heartfelt emails about why they had moved or why they wanted to move back. Some of them asked to do so kind of anonymously, as if they might
Northerners Anonymous.
I guess people who are employed in London who don't want to go, I'm seriously considering it in public. But the biggest one was people with children who want to have room for children to grow up and not have to have children breathing London air and things like that.
Yeah, I kind of hear that. I mean, I sometimes get that worry, and I have all the family ties down here and, you know, own a London flat, and I still worry about the possibility of getting somewhere big enough to have a family one day. So for someone who doesn't have those things, but does have like a lovely sort of northern mill town or whatever they come from, I can totally see why that's part of the equation. And this is, you know, as we've discussed at great length, this is why this country is screwed, that there's jobs at one half of the country and homes in the other, and it's really difficult to find somewhere you can get both.
Well, this is an interesting thing. Actually, a lot of people younger, a lot of people around my age who aren't planning to have kids soon, shared a similar sense of frustration that they are essentially tied to London if they want to work in certain fields. So, for instance, a good friend of mine, Sarah, wrote and said, "I moved south 10 years ago to go to a university. After graduating in a recession, no idea what I wanted to do. I went to London to do a master's. I'm still in London 7 years later," and she works in the heritage sector. So,
and heritage is all over. Heritage is not a London-specific phenomenon, right?
But I think to get jobs in her specific archive work, you either have to move around constantly or you can live in London and move institutions, because they are so concentrated in London. And also her partner is a civil servant, so she is now tied to London. But she says, "I think about it mostly when I'm sandwiched between four people on an overcrowded train having a panic attack quietly, or every January when the price of my travel card goes up. There are a lot of things I like about London and a lot of opportunities it has afforded me, but it makes me tired. A lot of things feel fragile and a lot of it has to do with the cost of living. If an opportunity came up to move back or elsewhere in the north, I would go tomorrow. I would also like to be able to procure oatcakes freely and walk in the peaks."
But the point about her partner being a civil servant is an interesting one. Not, I mean, partly because the government is down here, but also because it becomes a matter of not just getting one good job opportunity in a different bit of the country. Once you're coupled up, you need two. And that's an order of magnitude harder to achieve, to kind of coordinate that for sort of both halves of the relationship at once. And okay, you can live on one salary for a bit or whatever, but like, you can't really ask a partner to give up their career.
to kind of move? I mean, yeah, I'm doing a PhD, and this is the constant problem for academics, is you have to move city all the time. And it's a kind of famous curse of trying to have a relationship while in academia, is either you drag someone with you or you do long distance for years. But it is interesting that both job opportunities and wages in those jobs are in a position where you have to really hunt and plan and save to be able to do a move like that now.
Do you know what my proposed solution to all this is?
Is it move Parliament to Hull and raise the salaries a lot?
You're not far off. Originally, it was Bradford, and I wrote as much in a piece for The Guardian, which was largely because Bradford is basically the middle of the country. It's much prettier than anyone thinks it is. And I think if we put Parliament there, then like they would actually sort of have to invest in links across the north. Plus, there was a point where there was a great big hole in the middle of Bradford where you could quite easily put a Parliament, but they've since put a bloody shopping centre there. So thanks, Westfield. So now I'm kind of accepting the inevitable that if we're actually seriously going to talk about this, then it's got to be Manchester, right? Of the major British cities, Manchester is kind of the most central in the... I mean, I keep Birmingham, the more that we consider that the Midlands. But if you look at the whole of Great Britain, Manchester's the one that's kind of in the middle. It's a shorter journey to, on average, to other major British cities. And there's already sort of a lot of grand architecture. There's a lot of political institutions going to be there. And also, it would be more plausible to persuade the Westminster bubble people to move to Manchester than to move to a lot of other places. Not easy, but it's not completely implausible.
So maybe if you replied to our tweet saying you'd like to move back up north, join our campaign to do the reverse, to empty the Arndale Centre and fill it with disgruntled politicians.
Works for me. You've been listening to Skylines, the City Metric podcast. It was presented by John Lidge and Stephanie Boland and produced by Royfield Brown. You can contact all three of us on Twitter, where there's a pretty good chance we'll talk back. Our theme music was Waves by CORTR. You also heard We Are One by Vic Zento. All music in the show is licensed under Creative Commons. You can find Skylines every 2 weeks on Acast, on iTunes, or in the podcatcher of your choice. You can also find two more shows by Erickson and colleagues, Seriously and the New Statesman podcast. In the meantime, you can find all the stories about cities, maps and geography you could ever possibly want on our website, citymetric.com. And since you've listened this far, leave us a nice review on iTunes, eh? Go on, we love you for it. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.